How do you like your coffee? Freshly roasted? You can just smell it, can't you? Well, how would you like it brought to you? If you're passionate about your coffee, then a Passion for the Bean is for you. At a Passion for the Bean, they custom roast coffee beans from around the world when you place your order, so your coffee is guaranteed to be fresh, rich, full-bodied, and full of flavor. That's not the taste that you get from coffee beans that have been sitting on a supermarket or coffee house shelf for weeks. Now, to have the ultimate coffee experience delivered to your home or office, call a Passion for the Bean at 480-703-2326. That's 480-703-BEAN. A Passion for the Bean has joined forces with the American Stroke Association in the fight to end stroke. Now, you can help by purchasing an ASA signature blend, and 30% of the proceeds will go directly to the ASA. Help us put an end to stroke. The life you save may be your own. And call a Passion for the Bean today, 480-703-2326.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where we deal each week with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in our lives by identifying the difference between body, mind, spirit, and creating a greater consciousness on all spheres and learning how to integrate them so that balance is what occurs. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question is here, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So this is a live call-in show, and we're going to be talking tonight about social anxiety. And if you have a question or a comment, I'll be giving the number throughout the show, and the number is 480-949-1310. That's in the Phoenix area, 480-949-1310. And if you're calling from outside the Phoenix area, if you're listening via the Internet, which I know a number of you are because I get emails from time to time from you guys, the same number, 480-949-1310. So as I said earlier, the topic of tonight's show is social anxiety. Now, if you've listened to the show before, you know I'm not shy about talking about my own issues and history and things like that. But I would say that growing up especially, social anxiety as a kid was definitely something that controlled my life and relationships and school and everything about me. I grew up an overweight kid that was teased and bullied at school. I just remember that sports or anything related to physical activities just sent me over the edge in terms of anxiety. So I really stayed away and didn't participate, which then isolated me even more and made me a very shy kid in a lot of ways. And I remember also in school the whole idea of giving an oral report. And now listen, everything I'm saying, many of you listening to this can relate to a certain extent to everything I'm talking about right now, whether it's your own childhood, whether it's your kid's childhood, whether it's you as an adult still experiencing some of this. Anxiety is something we all experience. It's when it becomes something that controls our lives that it becomes pathological and becomes dysfunctional and something that really needs to be addressed, or else we keep spiraling down into a life that is more and that is smaller and smaller and smaller. So even with oral reports, I remember so often, even through graduate school, that any time I had to get up, that I knew in advance I had to get up in front of a classroom, or give a speech in any way, shape, or form. I wouldn't have slept the whole night before, and I remember my body trembling and my mind going blank, or at least my fear of it going blank, and I remember sweating, and it was just, like for a lot of people, the idea of public speaking just creates this total sense of terror. And that's the way I grew up. Now, I won't get into it now, but things happened along the way that allowed me to grow out of it. And you can tell, you know, I'm on radio and I've been doing this for years. And you give me a microphone and I'm in heaven. I mean, it's the ham inside of me that started coming out at a certain point, and I found out how much fun this can really be. And we're going to be talking tonight about what social anxiety is, what panic is, what performance anxiety is, and how to make those shifts, how to make those changes, because, again, this is something that, to some extent or another, affects every human being on this planet. So, with all that being said, I want to introduce my guest tonight, who is an expert in this field. His name is Jonathan Berendt. He's a licensed clinical social worker, and he's pioneered psychotherapy for social, public speaking, and performance anxiety, blushing, shyness, and other related disorders. And he has written a book called Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties. He's been on most of the major TV and radio programs, and now he's on Tell the Truth Faster. And he's taking time in his Friday night on the East Coast, so you got to give him a lot of credit, because he's on the East Coast tonight. It's much later. And Jonathan Berendt, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. Are you there?
And I do promise to tell the truth.
Okay, there you are. I didn't have you there for a minute.
Okay.
You heard that whole intro, I'm assuming.
I did. That was very nice.
Good. And talk about what is anxiety, and what's the difference between anxiety in general and social anxiety, as you define it?
Well, let's talk about social anxiety. It's a very insidious problem that is the third biggest mental health problem in our society. It affects at least one out of every eight individuals of all ages in every different culture. And the psychotherapy profession, the medical profession, and the school systems are, in essence, helpless. They do not understand this problem. Although there are millions and millions of people who suffer, it is very, very hard to find an actual structured psychotherapy program in effect to treat this population. And the reason being that it is a disease of resistance. I'll give you a few examples. Fear, as you mentioned before, fear of public speaking, panic attacks in response to authority figures, fear of blushing, which is hyperhidrosis, school phobia, selective mutism, which is an extremely insidious problem where children do not speak, often misdiagnosed as a speech disorder. It is an anxiety problem, and involuntary virginity. And the list goes on and on. But the most important thing to understand when considering shyness and social anxiety is that while there are many different examples of the problem, there are two basic types of people who have it. One is the person who is capable of initiative for the process of healing. Initiative does not mean ability. Initiative means to start up. And everybody else does not have initiative. For example, one of my patients today, a very successful businessman making about $1 million a year in advertising, has learned over the last 20 years to be so manipulative, so slippery, to avoid specific interactive scenarios where he will have panic. And it's gotten to the point that he obsesses so much and he worries so much that a major depression has set in. This is an example of someone who has initiative. Even though he's 42 years old and he's waited 20 years later to make a phone call to get some help, he is doing something about it. Another example is you have a child who's 7 years old who goes to school. And the schools are opening soon, so it's another cycle of anxiety. This child goes to school, never talks in school. The teachers do not know how to handle it, and they don't even give this child attention at the beginning. Who are the kids who get attention in school? The ADD hyperactive kids who are bouncing off the walls. The kids with social anxiety and severe shyness suffer in silence, and they don't get attention until there is a major problem. But this 7-year-old, as well as the 16-year-old who has school phobia, are incapable of taking initiative for the problem. So here we come to a very controversial issue. In a situation where people who have social anxiety do not have initiative, it's up to the parents to learn what to do. If they do not, you will have what in most cases turns out to be a permanent disability.
Well, I want to say something about that because I totally agree with you on that. The problem that I know that I have seen over the years is that the parents are so anxious about the problem their kids are having that they move into a place of denial and sense of hopelessness and this feeling of inadequacy that the parents themselves get so anxious that they don't know how to take the next step. So what do you say to those parents that might be listening who identify with what I just said about the importance of putting the kid first and dealing with their own issues to get past that? I mean, I would think that's something you find quite often when you're dealing with a kid.
I do see it quite often, and since 1978, I've worked with over 10,000 people, either directly or having supervised treatment, which is probably more, not to pat myself on the back, but which is probably more than any other therapist or organization in the world with a social anxiety. What I would say, and that was very good, and what I would say to the parents of dependents in that situation is a couple of things. Number one, your most valuable asset in life is time. You can borrow money, you can't borrow time. And when you have this type of anxiety, time becomes the enemy because there's all kinds of rationalization of the child will grow out of it. That's the biggest mistake that is made. Don't worry, little Johnny's just shy. He'll grow out of it. Well,
but that's still their way of avoiding dealing with the situation completely themselves.
That is correct. So when there are substantial patterns of social avoidance in early childhood, you have to understand that in most cases the child has to learn their way out of the problem, which is very, very possible if you have the right help. The other thing that I would say to these parents, and I have hundreds of stories like this, literally, in my book, Beyond Shyness, and at my website, socialanxiety.com, where there's a lot of diagnostic free information, is you want to hear the stories of the kids when they're 21 and they're 28 years old and 35 years old when they can't function and they're up in their room playing the computer games all day long and all night long, and they don't socialize, and they're overly dependent on parents. Social anxiety is, I refer to it as an addiction to avoidance. The degree of avoidance will tell you a lot about the problem. You cannot be good at being addicted if there is not enabling. And I'm not parent bashing, by the way. I'm just being a very matter of fact here. As a matter of fact, when my book first came out and it was published by Simon & Schuster quite a few years ago, it was one of the first books written on the subject of shyness and social anxiety based on an actual program, clinical program, not some of the ridiculous research that is going on. The publishing industry said, you're writing a book on shyness, why are you writing about parents? Very simply, if I didn't address the parenting needs because of this addiction to avoidance, I never would have had a practice or the material to have the clinical information about.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. So what's the advice you give to the parents in the book?
The advice that I give the parents is, number one, to be objective about what's going on. You need some objective diagnostics so that you know that, you know, there is a problem present. And then what we teach parents is the difference between empowering and enabling. Many parents have the best intentions in the world, but they mistake nurturing for rescuing. And nurturing means provide support and promote growth. So this translates into empowering the child into the difficult situations. You said something like this in your introduction. It's okay to have anxiety. It's not okay to let the anxiety control you. And all too often, the children who turn into adolescents, who turn into adults, learn this attitude that the world will adjust to them instead of the other way around, and that's where the pathology fits in. But here's another very important thing, and I'll give you a couple of examples, because people who don't have social anxiety just don't understand it. A woman comes into my office in Great Neck, New York, homemaker, mother of two, 40 years old, happens to be an ovarian cancer survivor, and she says with very genuine words, "Jonathan, I'd rather be back in chemotherapy than speak in front of a group."
Hmm.
I thought that was fairly mind-blowing. Another woman, one
yes.
of my patients in Tennessee, I do a lot of work over the phone, was considering, this is a very bright, successful businesswoman, married, kids, was considering getting an operation to sever her nerves because of blushing and sweating. Now, I think these are dramatic stories. The reason that I tell them is to characterize the emotions of shame, humiliation, and embarrassment that people with social anxiety and social phobia experience. This is very, very hard to understand. And this is one of the reasons, segueing into another issue here, which is extremely important, this is one of the reasons that has opened the door to a tremendous amount of clinically criminal behavior in our society via the use of pharmaceuticals, where
mm-hmm.
the pharmaceutical companies have taken advantage of this very desperate population, and so many people, after seeing these commercials on TV for the last 10 years or whatever, are left believing that they've got a chemical imbalance, it's a biological problem, a pill is the answer. I can assure you nothing is further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have identified on the show before that at age 45, which is about 11 years ago, I was diagnosed with ADD without the hyperactive component. And being somebody who comes from a very holistic and even metaphysical approach to dealing with things, I had to really think for a while about whether to turn towards the medication. And the place that I got to with this is that there is use and there's abuse, and that there is a time and a place in the clinical work for the use of it. And I know what a tremendous difference the medications for my ADD made in my life. The transformation was incredible. But beyond that, it's about, to me, it's about, and even with meds for anxiety, it's about using them to as minor place as you can to allow the person at least enough relief that they can start dealing with the psychosocial issues, the psychological issues, the emotional issues, so that they can get to a place where they're actually developing the tools and the skills to be more self-empowered and to be more confident so that the medications are not necessary.
That's very good. There's a right and a wrong way to use medicine with social anxiety. And with social anxiety, it comes in layers. There's layers to the problem. There's the avoidance and overdependence. There's the anxiety itself. There's the self-esteem problem. Many people are depressed as one of the results of social anxiety. But the way to use medicine, the time to use medicine is that when the person is overwhelmed with anxiety or obsessive characteristics or depression, you do give medicine, the purpose of which is to create a sense of ease in the brain so that the person can do the real work emotionally mm-hmm. and behaviorally, the longer-term objective of which is to not need the medicine, because that can breed overdependence, which is part of the problem to begin with. And when you
right.
talk about ADD, you're bringing up a very important issue. When I started my career in 1978, I discovered social anxiety by fate. I was working in a community center, and one of my colleagues had an idea. Let's start a – this is before the word social anxiety really was out there. She said, let's start a socialization group for teenagers who have learning disabilities. I had no idea what she was talking about. But we started this group, and an interesting thing happened. After we would do the interviews, the kids wouldn't come back to the group. I said, what's going on here? That's how I discovered social anxiety. But one of the things that I discovered over the years is about 50% of the many thousands of individuals that we have worked with have had some kind of a learning disability, which is a hidden handicap, which refers to difficulty that the brain has in processing information.
Right.
The pattern there is that the child who has an LD at an early age is susceptible to internal confusion, hence more mistakes, which creates anxiety, which leads to avoidance, the more of which develops into poor self-esteem. It's been such a common profile that I've seen, and it's just amazing that I have not seen this identified in too many places, this pattern.
Well, I agree with you totally, because, I mean, I look back at my own childhood. I mean, it took 45 years for this to get diagnosed, and I'm a therapist, and I didn't put the pieces of the puzzle together, you know, and ultimately it leads to isolation, depression, withdrawal, and it just feels safer being alone and at the same time longing for human contact and longing for social interaction and acceptance and things like that. It becomes a real inner conflict about something that as human beings we naturally need, which is that socialization, and yet the terror of being found out that your brain's not working right, or you're not capable, or you're inadequate, you know, all those things put somebody in that dark place where you can't move forward and you can't move back, and you're just stuck in that one place. And I'm assuming that that's what you're talking about, and you see that often with children and adults.
I see it often, yes. A lot of people are terribly horrified at the possibility of being perceived as being noticeably nervous. Again, there are many different functioning levels of people who have this problem. I work with many people around the country who are internationally, actually, who are very, very high achievers. They are perfectionists. They are very, very obsessive. And they are so obsessively locked into perfection that they don't cut themselves any slack with being perceived as anything less than perfect. That can be part of a major obsessive disorder and can create a lot of worry and depression, but it's very common. Listen, one thing that I'd like to do is, and I like to do this when I do shows like this, is if there are listeners out there who can relate to this and they'd like to make a phone call, the first person who calls with a phone call or a question or a statement about social anxiety, I will give away a free copy of the book, Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties by Simon & Schuster.
Excellent. I appreciate that. And I'm going to remind my listeners that the number to call is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310, just like KXAM 1310 in Phoenix, which is the station we're on. So if you have a question or a comment, or you can relate to something that we're talking about tonight, feel free to call in, and Jonathan Berent will give you a free copy of Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties. So
I also want to tell your listeners that there is a ton of free information and free diagnostic profiles at socialanxiety.com. That's socialanxiety.com. What you were talking about just a minute ago reminds me, there are many people, again, there are many different functioning levels of people with social anxiety, and I was addressing the high achievers. Then we have the people who live at a very primitive level. And these are not only children and teenagers, but many, many young adults who are, I hate to use the word, but they are pathologically avoidant and pathologically overly dependent on their parents. These are the people who are playing computer games, 45 hours a week. One of my patients in Iowa, happens to be in Iowa, and when I started working with him, I did not think really that there was going to be a lot of success. He's a recovering alcoholic. He's 150 pounds overweight, and he has a ton of social anxiety. But he's been making wonderful progress. And one of the things that he told me in our telephone session the other day is that before he started talking to me, he thought that his life was going to be coming home from work every day, getting drunk, and playing this one computer game for the rest of his life. I have seen people spend 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week on the internet, and many obsessed with computer games. One 32-year-old comes into my office for his first session. The only reason he was there is because his parents forced him to be. As a matter of fact, he hid in the bathroom overnight before his session. He was so scared of coming. Comes in, can't make eye contact, no social skills, no peer relationships, no social life outside of the family. He made $32,000 one day, doing a very sophisticated maneuver on the internet, getting into an IPO, because you know, he'd fall asleep at night with his clothes on. I talk about the addiction to avoidance. Within that addiction, we have technology, which can be a wonderful thing, but it also has a very dark side.
Granted. And it's not just the games. It's also people who become so enamored with the cybersex issues because it's the only way they can have a relationship of sorts, even if it's a fantasy one or it's only chat, that the social anxiety is so great that there are no intimate relationships and that the cybersex and the cyber chats are the only way they feel comfortable enough to actually have any kind of contact. And I'm sure you see that quite a lot in your practice. How do you approach that with those clients?
Well, that depends if the person has initiative or not. If the person has initiative, we're going to try to teach this person to nurture themselves away from this dependence and to invest in other social opportunities. If the person does not have initiative, which is typical for the person who is pathologically dependent on computer games or the internet, we have to teach the parents how to restructure the environment on which the child is, the dependent is dependent. The perfect example is a very interesting thing with social anxiety in recent years. There is a disorder called selective mutism. And just as it sounds, the person is capable of speaking, talks normally, usually at home, but does not speak to outside of the home, although there are many variations to this. It's often misdiagnosed as a speech disorder, but it's an anxiety disorder. So the most ridiculous thing in the world is, and this really brings schools to their knees, you know, hardly anyone in a school knows how to diagnose it or treat it. And the first thing usually is you send the kid to speech therapy, which is an absurdity because it's not a speech problem. So the kid sits there with the speech therapist and doesn't say anything. You know, what's going to be accomplished? Or you take a kid like this to one-to-one therapy, psychotherapy. That's also an absurdity. This is the classic disease of avoidance and dependence. And the way that you treat this is that you teach the parents, after basic education of what the anxiety is, you teach the parents how not to enable, which means methodically, everything has to be done with a methodology or there's going to be problems. But you teach the parents how not to talk for the child, how not to think for the child, how not to do too much problem solving for the child. And by doing that, you help the child access the part of his or her brain where they don't want to go to. And the child learns, the dependent learns that they have to survive. When they don't get that message, they learn that the world will adjust to them, teachers will adjust to them, all the caregivers will, and it sets them up for a delusion further on in life. And for some reason, I've been treating selective mutism for a long, long time. For some reason, in the last few years, it's gotten a lot of publicity. And again, one of the bad things is that all too often, you hear that the answer for selective mutism is you take the child for Prozac or another selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And the issue is that if you don't integrate medicine at the right time, the right way, you will worsen the problem very often.
Wow. And I want to, again, remind my callers, the number is 480-949-1310. I want to, in the material on your website, which again, for those who are listening, is socialanxiety.com. You can also, if you don't remember that, you can remember the name of my show, Tell the Truth Faster, which is tellthetruthfaster.com, and there'll be a link. There already is a link on there to socialanxiety.com. But in the material on your website, which, by the way, I really liked because you take each aspect of what you're talking about, whether it's fear of public speaking or panic or social anxiety, and you consolidate it beautifully in something very brief and very understandable and very much to the point. And in one of the topics, you said that there are basically four components to dealing with this. One is emotional, one is behavioral, one is physiological, and one is thinking process. Now, I talk often about a holistic approach, and if there's ever a holistic approach to this, you just laid that out. Can you talk a little bit about, when you're dealing with social anxiety, what you're talking about with the emotional, the behavioral, the physiological, as well as thinking process?
Okay, let's take a very common, the most common phobia in the universe is fear of public speaking. Okay, now, I've done over 1,500 shows. I've done everything from Oprah to Opie and Anthony, if you know who they are, two very absurd shock jocks. And, you know, you talk about it. Once I was supposed to do Howard Stern, and I was sitting in my office. We were going to talk on involuntary virginity, which is a very legitimate form of social anxiety. Adults who are virgins who wish they were not, and they are, because of performance anxiety or identity issues. But anyway, I'm waiting in the office for this phone call. He blew me off, but my adrenaline, he blew me off for a hermaphrodite and the biggest rubber band ball in the world. But anyway, such a showbiz. But I'm sitting there waiting for the phone call, and with all of these shows that I've ever done, you know, in studio, out of studio, a million in the audience, 10 in the audience, my hands get cold. And the reason that my hands get cold is because my blood vessels constrict. This is part of the physiology of performance, and this is what so many people do not understand. So when we're talking about public speaking anxiety, the typical person gets up in front of a group, and they have anticipatory anxiety, and then the adrenaline flows. When the adrenaline flows, the physical symptoms start. Now, typically, the person, when this process starts, they get agitated, they get angry at the fact that the symptoms are happening, they push internally, and that makes the problem worse. The anger and the frustration makes it worse. When the person understands that the adrenaline flow is a natural part of the physiology of performance and they can accept it, that's the hardest thing, accept it and then breathe into it, surf the wave of it, roll with the punch of it, and then breathe into it, that's a classical example of the physiological technique that is needed to control the physical aspects of anxiety and distress. The emotional component goes as this.
Let me stop you right there on the physiological from before you move on. Because one of the things you're talking about is adrenaline, and the other way of putting it is learn to enjoy the adrenaline rush, which a lot of people get addicted to for a lot of destructive reasons, that you could actually ride the wave of that adrenaline rush to improve your presentation and your speech.
Absolutely. That's an advanced technique, but you're absolutely right, and that's what we try to teach people to do with their adrenaline.
Stuart, we have a caller, Janice from Mesa, on the line.
Okay, so let's go to Janice from Mesa.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Tell the Truth Faster.
Okay. Well, I was diagnosed with ADLD and everything you can think of, pretty much. And basically, they put me on so many medications when I was younger that it inhibited me from learning, you know, because I was basically drugged up the whole time. Later on, they found out that I also had a social anxiety disorder that was so severe that actually just, I used to make $125,000 a year working a high-powered job, graduated college, and then had a nervous breakdown because of all the people I had to work around. So now I moved to Mesa out of the city because I used to live in San Francisco because I couldn't handle being around large groups of people anymore. And since then, I have noticed that when I do receive a position at a job and I start having issues and I bring it to the upper management and say, hey, listen, I can't be in this situation, they always say, oh, what's wrong? Are you crazy? That I've heard that a million times. Are you crazy? And I think that, and I actually started up a group, and I'm slowly but surely getting more and more people involved, with people who have worked high-powered jobs and are intelligent and have ADD and LDD and other disorders. And I really, you know, hope that by you broadcasting the show and talking to people, that they will understand that, you know, this is a legitimate disorder. This isn't something that's just, you know, in your head and you can just get over. You know, it's something that happens every day, and in real life you have to deal with it with every day.
Mm-hmm. Which, unfortunately, a lot of us have heard, oh, it's all in your head, you know, it's like, why do you procrastinate, or why aren't you more organized? You know, it's just a matter of focusing and paying more attention to it. So I understand what you're saying, because most of us our whole lives have just heard people who hadn't understood what was really going on in our brains, that it's just mind over matter, and we should be able to just turn it on and turn it off. So I really appreciate what you're saying. Jonathan, you have a comment for Janice?
Yeah, I'm glad she called. I want you to produce her to take her name and address, and I'll send her a free book. But she made some very, very good points. There are so many people who are high-achieving people. I have one of my patients in Dallas, Texas, a CFO, making a ton of money, had a blackout, a semi-blackout with a panic attack in a board meeting. And she says, oh, my God, what if this happens? What if I'm on CNBC and I'm talking about the company and I have one of these blackouts? The stock of the company is going to go down. Okay? I mean, she's right. And these are people that you would never know have a problem. And people with social anxiety in general are not going to be identified other than the people with very pervasive problems who are hiding out in the, hiding out in their parents' house. This is a problem based on shame, humiliation, and embarrassment. 99.9% of the people who have the problem don't go for help. Most of those who do go for help get inappropriate help. And I must say, one of the biggest cliches in the therapeutic world is the use of the term cognitive behavioral therapist.
I've heard that a lot.
Pardon?
I've heard that a lot.
Okay, because, you know, what they think is, oh, you take the CBT stuff, and I'm not knocking it, but you take the CBT stuff, and anybody who has that can treat social anxiety. That's not the case, okay? You have to go deep. I've seen everything from a cure to the problem being permanent and everything in between. So we were addressing the physiological component, but here's the most important piece, and that's the emotional piece, because the emotions that rule people with this disease are fear of embarrassment, shame, humiliation.
And can I add one thing in with that? Because
go.
It's something I really want to say, and I've always wanted to say this
you're
to a large group of people, is the fact is that, you know, personally, I just lost everything because of this, you know, and I was literally locking myself in my home. I did not leave my house except to go to an emergency room a few times because of the anxiety. And what I realized later on is that through medication and through the proper sources, which I had to find on my own, I was able to overcome it to a point. And with a lot of, I think that it takes a lot for a person to come out and admit that they have this issue. And if they don't admit it, that, like they said, it's the first step in order to get over it is to admit that you have the situation. A lot of people live in denial over it and don't want to admit that they have the situation because they are embarrassed. Like
yeah, and, you know, I want to say, you know, thank you again. When you go to the website, socialanxiety.com, there, and you go to area of concern, and you see things like fear of blushing and sweating, panic attacks, selective mutism, school phobia, performance anxiety, there are free CDs available with excerpts from interviews with actual real patients who talk about how they resolved or how they cured, in some cases, the problem. It is possible. But the point that I was making is it's the demons of shame, embarrassment, and humiliation which cause the anxiety. And the road to true healing or a cure, and I don't use that term lightly, I use it very carefully, taking the conservative approach, is that when a person has self-acceptance, the performance anxiety dissipates greatly. Going back to my own performance, you know, I've done, as I said, Oprah and CNN and NBC and Sally Raphael, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. And usually I'm pretty good at these shows. And one of the reasons that I am is that I do not overvalue a mistake. And so many people with anxiety overvalue a mistake. Now, the baseball player who's making $10 million a year does not cry when he strikes out. He goes back to the dugout, and he focuses more intensively, more productively for the next time at bat. That's what life is all about if you're going to have what I refer to as a high-performance mind. Not only do you have to understand the physiology of performance, you have to learn from your mistakes. That's true nurturing.
Yeah. Janice, I also want to remind you and my listeners that today's show, if you go to my website, tellthetruthfaster.com, all the shows I've done for the last 4 years are archived on that site. So if you have other people in your group or others that you know that didn't hear the show tonight and want to, within the week, this show will be archived and they will be able to download it and listen to it for free. So I just want to pass that on to you. Have you listened to the show before? I'm always curious about that when I get a caller.
I actually haven't. I went to go get a book on CD today and decided I couldn't find one I liked, so I wanted to listen to something talk radio, and I just happened to hear what you were talking about and stopped.
Well, stay with us in the future. We're really grateful that you called in and took the time, and good luck with that group. If there's anything I can do, you just let me know.
Well, if they want to email me, I can give you my email address, and people can email me, and I'll be more than happy to get them involved in our group. And thank
you
so much again for talking to you.
What I'd prefer that you do is you go to the website, Tell the Truth Faster, email me that address. That way, instead of putting it out over the air and you'll get some crazy emails from a lot of people that are not really relating to this, I'll be able to pass it on to you.
Not a problem.
Okay?
That's wonderful.
Okay, and make sure you give your address and stuff to the to my engineer so that we can send you the book.
Okay, great. And thank you both so much, and best of luck, and I appreciate it.
Same to you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in. Jonathan, one other point I want to make about the fear of public speaking. The name of my show is Tell the Truth Faster, and a tool that I learned a long time ago that I pass on to a lot of people, and they really have appreciated it, is if you have to give a talk or do anything, and you're really nervous and really scared, tell the audience that that's the way you're feeling.
Yeah.
First of all, almost everybody in the audience is going to relate to it, and the next thing you know, you got friends throughout the audience, and you feel the support coming at them. Second of all, it's no longer a secret that you're afraid they're going to find out. And you can usually, in a sense, even make some jokes about it or lighten up about it, but at least it's out in the open, and it's not this big, dark secret. And I have found that it works tremendously for me. Or if I lose track of my thoughts, I just say, I just had an ADD moment. You're going to have to forgive me while I get back focused again. Everybody laughs. We kind of make light of it, and we get ahead of it. We move on. And it's about telling the truth faster and acknowledging that you're nervous or that you're anxious or that you're feeling scared and uncomfortable about giving a talk. And a lot of people report that it's a really good, simple technique that works for me and a lot of other people.
It's simple, but it's not simple. That technique is very,
yeah,
very good, but it takes a lot of confidence and a lot of self-acceptance. And
mm-hmm.
That's exactly, believe me, that was good. And I try to teach my patients that. But there are so many people who are so obsessive that this is a very important word, obsessive. It really literally means a brain tick, a mind tick, the repetitive nature of worry and specific thoughts, that they just can't do that. They just have to work at being so perfect. It's a very complex thing. I'll give you another example. I have at least three patients right now. They're all high achievers. They're all in work for corporations. They're all men. They all have public speaking anxiety. And they all are married with same-sex attraction. And one of the things that happens there is that there's two levels of fear that goes on. One is, the first level is, oh no, people can see that I'm nervous. And the second level, which is deeper, is, oh no, people can see who I really am. And what they're in essence doing is they're projecting this unresolved material onto the audience. There's a very thin line between anxiety and paranoia. But that's an example of how deep this problem can go. And a lot of people who have this problem believe, you know, whatever their source of performance or social anxiety is, that they are flawed as human beings because they have this anxiety. One of my patients in Washington, D.C., handsome, athletic, successful salesman, 42 years old, with his, he called me because of public speaking anxiety, and he, when I was on the phone with him originally, he said he thought that he had a character disorder.
Hmm.
Okay, now think of that. Anxiety, which is a very common thing, but it's so misunderstood. He was so internally confused that he referred to it as a character disorder and didn't go for any help until he was 42 years old, which is another common scenario.
Well, you talked about the number of men. Is there a difference in gender and social anxiety in terms of the numbers? Do you find it more with men or with women, or about even?
I at the beginning, if you would have asked me 20 years ago, I would have said more men. But right now, I really do see it as being even. And what I think was happening originally, and this is, I am not a sexist at all. This might sound like a sexist statement, but there was more pressure on men to perform in our society, and that it was easier to have the woman, the female, hidden by the family. I think that's changed, you know, in recent times. But I see it now as a pretty 50-50 phenomenon.
Hmm. Okay. Before Janice called in, we were talking about the physiological, and again, you were being very clear about the body's reactions and what people can notice. And to me, one of the best sources or the best procedures for working with anyone in a healing process in psychotherapy is to get them more in touch with what their body is telling them about comfort or stress or things like that. But you also mentioned thinking processes as one of the four items. What do you mean about how do you work with thinking processes and helping people become more aware of what they are?
Well, this is the cognitive component of it. And the typical scenario is thinking, I will make a mistake, I will look like a fool, you know, this kind of material, I will embarrass myself. Now, the way that you resolve this is that you have to help the person develop an objective perspective of what's going on versus the exaggerated emotion. You have to help the person develop a nurturing internal script versus the excessive internal critical script that is ruling them. One of the things that we do, that there is a piece of psychology that is called transactional analysis. You know, it's been around for a long time. And we've taken these terms and we've adapted it into modern scientific, you know, principles. And I use it very effectively with social anxiety in terms of helping people restructure their ego states or their mind states to create more logic, more nurturing, more creativity and experimentation instead of having such a high critical script which goes like, I will screw up, I will make a fool of myself, people will see who I really am, that kind of material that then hooks the exaggerated emotion in the form of anxiety, panic, or phobic avoidance.
Hmm. So it then is about restructuring the thought process or helping people become clearer in terms of what thoughts they're having, what those patterns have been throughout their lives, how it shows up in a current situation, and how to, in a sense, reprogram those thoughts into something more positive or something more reassuring, and something that deals with the reality of the situation as opposed to the terror of the situation.
That is correct, which depends on the quality of the emotional work that is done. And with anybody that I have ever worked with productively with an anxiety problem, these individuals have had to do some work on the underlying anger. Anger is energy, and a lot of people, another very important concept with anxiety is that people learn how to detach themselves from thinking and from emotions that don't feel good. So when they detach, they end up repressing the emotion, which recycles, which creates implosion, that's internal explosion, in the form of anxiety, obsessiveness, or depression. One of my patients from Hawaii, for example, started taking Zoloft, which is an SSRI, a couple of weeks before she initiated therapy with me. And in giving me her, it was very hard for her, in giving me her history, she was molested as a kid and, you know, had some troubles. She was a very bright person. But the point being, she would not have been able to do any therapy if she was not on the Zoloft. That created a sense of ease that allowed her to just get to the table to do the work. Without it, she wouldn't have been able to do it. So everybody has individual needs.
Right. That's what we were talking earlier about, the use or misuse of the medications and the drugs. And unfortunately, we live in a culture and a society that for years say, you know, you have a headache, take an aspirin, it'll go away, instead of you have a headache, well, what's going on that's stressing you out right now, and how often is this coming up, and how can you maybe use the aspirin to help alleviate it immediately, but still process what situations or circumstances are creating that headache to begin with.
Right, and building on the holistic approach, there is one other piece. When a person does have physical symptoms of anxiety, social anxiety, it's called autonomic hypersensitivity. And it is important also, I mean, I think the most important stuff is the emotional stuff, but it's also important to consider nutrition. And I will tell you that sugar is the enemy. We have a comprehensive audio program. It's also on the website, socialanxiety.com. This is the next best thing. For whatever reason, people don't want to be in therapy. This is the next best thing. And as part of the program, there is a very noted nutritionist, Anna Marie Colbin. She has a number of best-selling books. And she presents a nutritional program. And one of the most important things she says is, sugar is the enemy, but the problem is, there's a couple of problems. Sugar is in everything. And the other thing is that sugar is love. Because parents parents start giving sugar to their kids at a very early age to induce love, but it can create problems down the road.
Well, it's also something that parents use at a very early age to pattern behavior that they want. They use it as a reward, so all of a sudden we start thinking, well, you know, I deserve that hot fudge sundae, you know, and it becomes part of, you know, it's an addiction. You know, the body craves it and needs it, and it's about the highs and the lows that come from something like that. So we only have a few minutes left, and you very briefly talked about the issue of anger just a moment ago. And I really want you to at least say a little bit more about where anger comes into play with this, because I know for a lot of kids growing up who have been bullied, and I'm speaking in my own sense also, since we're not confident enough to really stand up and say, well, this makes me angry, we repress that anger, and that then intensifies, I would believe, the need to withdraw, because we're afraid people are going to see this rage in us, or that it's going to do damage, or we're going to do damage. So what do you say to people who may be in denial about the level of anger or rage that's in there and what to do about it?
Well, we're going to try to help them tap into the anger, and this is a confusing thing. It's not the type of anger usually where people slam doors or have road rage. It's at a very structural level. Where people are angry because they're not happy enough in life. They're not getting what they want. And the deepest dynamic of anger is that it's related to the lack of self-acceptance that exists. But there is a very small percentage of people who do act out. The typical person with anxiety does not act out with anger. But what has happened over the last decade, if you look at the pattern of school violence, it's not the socially well-adjusted kid with good social skills that chewed up their fellow kids. It's usually the children who have been picked on, who are lower in the social pecking order, who are somewhat socially handicapped, and they have acted out with their anger. And there is a tremendous amount of anger and rage. Any time that a person is picked on and bullied, and more often than not, the kids who experience this hide it. I'll leave you with one story. A learning disabled 16-year-old used to be on the bus, and the kids would pick on her, put gum in her hair, throw spitballs at her. They would harass her mercilessly. She had no friends. She comes into one of my groups, which is a specialized social group for kids with learning disabilities. For the first time in her life, she has friendships. She has self-esteem. And life is going good. When she's 20 years old, she was on her way to community college, and crossing the street, a car comes by and kills her. Mm. And the parents were very religious people, and the mother told me that, with the most genuineness in the world, that thank God while she was on this earth that she knew what it was like to have good self-esteem. And a lot of people with social anxiety never have that experience.
Wow. Jonathan Berendt, licensed clinical social worker, author of Beyond Shyness, How to Conquer Social Anxieties. Jonathan, thank you. I know it's 11 o'clock your time in Great Neck, New York. I want to thank you for staying up this late and being a part of tonight's show.
Thank you. You were a good interviewer.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I appreciate it. And I want to remind my listeners that I'm here every Friday night from 7 to 8 o'clock in the Phoenix area on KXAM 1310 AM. And if you want more information or you want to hear this show again, you could go to TellTheTruthFaster.com. You can get the hyperlink to socialanxiety.com if you want to get in touch with Jonathan Berendt. Or I would love to hear from you and your reactions to the show anytime. So this is Stuart Altshuler, Tell the Truth Faster, and this is KXAM 1310 AM in the Phoenix area. Thank you for listening. Everybody have a great weekend, and I'll be back here again next Friday night with Tell the Truth Faster. Have a great weekend, everyone.